I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Our guest this hour spent a year eating fish at every meal. And he traveled all over the world, Peru and Norway and Alaska, the Arctic Circle, eating that fish and looking at what's happening in the world's oceans and fish farms. Some of you may have seen his findings in the Fish on My Plate, a Frontline documentary that premiered last night. You can still watch it online in case you missed it last night, so go online. It's really fascinating. Paul Greenberg was working on his upcoming book, The Omega Principle, and he consumed over 700 fish meals in hopes of improving his health through a dramatic increase in his omega-3 levels. He went to Norway, where modern fish farming was invented and where there is a salmon war. He went to Peru to see the world's largest wildlife fishery. He went to Alaska, where millions of salmon are caught every year, Connecticut to visit a sustainable ocean farming pioneer, and to the Arctic Circle as well. He's the author of other books. He's a New York Times bestselling author, essayist, and lifelong fisherman who writes about fish, aquaculture, and the future of the ocean. His latest book is American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood, which was released in 2014. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think there will be many. Many of you had a chance to see the documentary, and many of you like fish, and the stories that are in this documentary were new to me. It's a fascinating film to see, and we'll be talking about it and welcoming your phone calls at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hello, Paul.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. What a trip that was. And did you ever eat the fish? My gosh, you ate fish. I couldn't believe how much fish you ate.
I'm positively glowing.
And we'll find out how your health is later on.
Yeah.
You had a chance to go to so many fascinating places. I had no idea that Peru was as big as it was in the anchovy business.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's, you know, the biggest wild fish fishery in the world. And almost nobody I know had ever heard of it before. And the main reason is because, you know, while a few of those Peruvian anchovies, they're also called anchoveta in Spanish, while a few of those might end up on your plate, 99% of this massive catch actually never crosses the lips of a human. And it's all that fish is ground up and turned into meal and oil and then fed to pigs and chickens and most recently farmed salmon. So it's this completely industrialized fish that's invisible to people. So we thought that was, you know, Frontline being the investigative program that it is, we thought we should investigate.
Yeah, and we don't eat it because we don't like the taste?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. What's your feeling about anchovies?
Well, I haven't had one since my mom liked them. And she's been gone for a while, so I haven't had an anchovy in a long time.
Well, let me tell you, I've eaten quite a few anchovies this past year.
I know.
I find them delicious. I actually find them to be really useful in the kitchen. You know how in Japanese cooking, you might have heard there's this idea of umami, which is like the other taste sense. It's sort of translated as deliciousness. And you know, I think in the Asian idea of the palate, there's sweet, salt, bitter, sour, and then right, and the fifth thing is umami. And turns out that anchovies, when treated well in the kitchen, can give even non-fish dishes a really nice, savory, tasty thing. So I really like using anchovies in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
But as for, you know, why Americans don't eat them, I think, you know, it's interesting that your mom ate them because an older generation in the States was fairly accustomed to canned fish,
yes,
partly because they predated refrigeration. And, you know, back in the day, you might also recall that back in the day, you couldn't really get Alaskan wild salmon as a fresh piece of fish or as a frozen portion that you could then treat like any other fish. Back in the day, the only thing going in Alaska was a cannery, and so that was the only way you got your fish. And particularly oily fish like sardines and like salmon, they need to be dealt with right after capture, or otherwise they'll spoil.
Mm-hmm. You talk in the documentary about Peru having a well-managed fish industry.
Yeah.
I want to hear more about that. And you also say, which is interesting, it's too easy to say that the fishing industry is bad and conservationists are good. It's not that black and white.
No, it isn't. You know, fisheries management is, some people call it an art, some people call it a science. It's something in between. But the artful nature of it has to do with how you have to figure out how to make humans work in inside the context of an ever-changing natural system. So Peruvian anchoveta, as it's called, is a particularly dynamic system because it's very much controlled by water temperature and by fluctuations in El Nino years. So when you get an El Nino event, what happens is there is not very much mixing between the nutrient-rich levels of the water and the surface water. You get a hot surface level that just sort of sits there like a kind of a ceiling on a crypt. And because you're not getting the nutrient flow, you don't get the planktonic flow, and then you don't get the anchoveta bloom. So the combination of those factors means that in El Nino years, you have to really dial back the fishing to make sure you're not digging yourself into a hole. In the past, like, for example, as we talk about in the Frontline film, in Monterey Bay, for example, they had an El Nino-like event in the 40s, didn't curtail the fishing sufficiently, and then saw the sardine catch just plummet. And the whole, you know, listeners might have read or seen Cannery Row.
Right.
Well, that whole thing disappeared, and largely because the fishing industry and climate was out of sync.
Mm. And the factories were shipped to Peru.
And they were shipped to Peru, yeah. I mean, that was perhaps the most fascinating thing for me to discover during this research, was that, you know, fishing effort, when a fishery crashed or fishermen were told not to fish anymore, all that equipment, the canneries, the boats, and so forth, those don't just go away because they're really, you know, actually valuable assets. And so what happened in the 40s, 50s, 60s is that a lot of that industry migrated to Peru, right down in some cases. There was one example of a cannery that had been dismantled entirely and then put back together outside of the U.S. with a door that had the same nameplate on the door as when it was taken apart, and then the same guy walked in the door.
Oh my gosh!
So, you know, same place, different
right,
or same factory, different place.
So. Yeah. So these anchovies or anchovetas are very high in omega-3 fatty acids.
They are indeed, and actually, that was another thing that we explored during the Frontline doc is, you know, do you take fish oil pills yourself?
You know, I used to because I've had heart problems. And then I had this show on some time ago where people were saying that, you know, there's no scientific studies showing that fish oil does much for you. So I stopped taking them.
Interesting. Well, so I'm in the middle, you know, as I think you introduced me, I'm in the middle of actually writing a book
right.
all about omega-3 fatty acids. And so I've been looking quite a bit into this question of, do omega-3s work or do they not? And I've even went last year. You didn't mention this in the intro because it wasn't part of the film, but last year I went to the International Convention of the Global Organization for EPA and DHA fatty acids in the Canary Islands, of all places.
Oh.
And it, you know, it was interesting there because they had really been exposed to a lot of the bad press that had come around. What really led to a lot of reversals in thinking on omega-3s was a couple of very big what are called meta-analyses, where they looked at a range of different studies and sort of did a study of studies. And in a particularly famous one that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2012, they found what they call a no significant effect in cardiovascular in various events in cardiovascular health, so heart attacks, strokes, and so forth. Other studies, now keep in mind that was a meta-analysis of what are called randomized control trials, where one group of people is getting fish oil pills, the other group's not getting anything.
Right.
So that's one kind of study, and that's considered the gold standard in scientific circles. But there are other studies that have value, and they're called cohort studies or observational studies, where they take into account a much larger population and much longer time period. And in those studies, there was a paper, I think, in the journal Nature in 2016 that showed us, you know, 6% reduction in cardiovascular death, I think, as a result of all those studies. So which ones do you believe? It's hard to say, I think. I mean, scientists will always say go with the randomized control trial, but I've spent enough time in what I can think of as the omega world to think that there is something there, but it may have something to do with larger dietary patterns that have to do with how we've changed the way we eat during the last 100 years.
Yeah. Well, it's an understatement to say you've been involved in the omega world for a long time. I don't know anybody who's been more involved.
You know, there's the fish world, which is its world, its own world, and it has a lot. It often pings off of the omega world.
Right.
The omega world itself, there is a whole range of scientists. I mean, omega-3 fatty acids are one of the most studied substances on Earth. There are over 30,000 trials at this point.
Goodness gracious!
Yeah, or studies, I should say. So it's inching up on aspirin as perhaps one of the most studied things on Earth. And it's not that omega-3s are irrelevant. And that's just the thing that's tricky about them, is that they are clearly involved in cellular health. The question is, if a little of them is good, is a lot of them better? And that's the debate, I think, that's happening within the medical community.
Well, somebody told you along the way that you should be taking six of these big pills every day.
Yeah, I mean, that was, granted, look at who the messenger was. But
right.
He was saying this was a fish oil plant manager in Peru. And by the way, if your listeners are taking fish oil supplements, probably that fish oil is coming from Peru, from the same enchiladas that we've been talking about. So we went to a plant, a newly built plant, north of Lima, or just south of Lima, actually. And the fish oil plant manager, nice Canadian guy named Dave, actually named Dave Matthews. no relation to Ben, but he said he took 2 to 3 grams of fish oil a day. He said he had super low cholesterol, excellent cholesterol, super low cholesterol, low blood pressure, all these kinds of things that we'd like to see if we're at risk for cardiovascular health. So, that's why I call it Omega World. In Omega World, 2 to 3 grams a day is not an unreasonable amount of fish oil to take.
Mm-hmm. So are you taking it now?
No, I don't take fish oil. I'm really not a medicator of any kind, and I'm a little bit, probably to my detriment, medicine averse. I do believe, Hippocrates famously said, let thy diet be thy medicine, and let thy medicine be thy diet.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think a lot of the way we eat, I don't know if it can resolve existing problems, but I think a lot of the problems we get into in the first place have to do with diet.
Mm-hmm. You're asking, I can't remember where you were. I thought the guy was Danish, this very older gentleman who looked fit as a fiddle, and you were talking to him about fish oil and omega-3 and talking to him about the studies that had shown that maybe it wasn't that beneficial, but he really said that there were going to be major studies coming out, I believe, in the next couple of years.
Yeah, well, first of all, that was no random older gentleman. That was Jorn Dyerberg, who is the one of the preeminent scientists in the omega-3 world. In the 1970s, Jorn Dyerberg and his supervisor, Hans Bang, went to Greenland, and they were the ones who looked at medical records of cardiovascular death in the Inuit community,
mm-hmm.
and then sampled the blood of many Inuits there, spun the blood down, and compared it actually with Inuits who had emigrated to Denmark, because remember, Greenland had once been part of Denmark. So they then compared the blood between those two populations, Inuits in Denmark eating a Western diet and Inuits in Greenland eating an indigenous seafood-based diet. And they found that the ones that were in Greenland had very high levels of EPA and DHA, omega-3 fatty acids, in their blood. And then the deduction was made. Well, if they have low levels of cardiovascular disease, high levels of omega-3 in their blood, well, then that must be the reason. But, of course, correlation does not prove causation, and that is really the center of the omega-3 debate. Is the presence of these things in populations of low cardiovascular disease proof that those are, in fact, the factors that are mm-hmm. making them fitter and less sick from cardiovascular disease?
Mm. So when are we going to know the truth? Will your book give us the truth?
Oh, well, yeah, all right. Sorry, you asked about it. So as Jorn Dyerberg pointed out, there are at least three major studies that are coming out with many, many thousands of participants. The most sort of hoped-for result and anticipated result is something called the VITAL study that is being done at Brigham Women's Hospital. And they're looking at both omega-3 fatty acids and they're looking at vitamin D. And now, if memory serves me correctly, they're not only looking at cardiovascular disease. I think they're also looking at some dementia and mental health issues as well. So I'm tracking that. I'm in a little bit of a bind because I just turned in a second draft of my book, and the VITAL study comes out July 2018, which is pretty much when my book comes out. So we're going to be out of sync. So I'm going to have to make some educated guesses as to where they're going. But, we'll see. I'll probably end up writing about it as a spinoff from the book. But I think one way or another, by 2018 into 2019, I think we'll have a clearer idea of effect and whether or not it's there.
Now, let's go to the salmon industry for a while, because it's been probably sold as this is the fish that's best for you to eat because it's very rich in these omega fatty acids.
Yep.
And I was absolutely astounded to see what was going on in Norway. There are salmon wars going on in Norway. There were all kinds of environmental concerns. I had no idea.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been going for a long time. In Norway, there are over 1,000 salmon sites, salmon farming sites, all up and down the coast of Norway. And if you superimpose them on a map of salmon, wild salmon rivers in Norway, they're pretty much one for one. In other words, you tend to farm salmon in places where wild salmon would have thrived.
Mm-hmm.
Because of a number of factors, the damming of rivers, you know, salmon need rivers to spawn and complete their life cycle. So if you dam a river, you lose a salmon run. So that's one factor. Pollution is another factor. At sea, open ocean fishing that really hit hard in the 60s and 70s off of the Faroe Islands and places where Norwegian salmon would have migrated. Anyway, all these different things reduce the number of wild salmon in the world. And then on top of it, starting in the 70s, you throw on top of it all of these salmon farms, which environmentalists there really strongly believe is kind of like the coup de grace, and it's the last blow that is really driving salmon, wild salmon, into extirpation. And you know, it's again like the omega-3 debate. It is complicated. There are some people out there who've done some observations saying that the diseases that the salmon farms throw off are actually infecting other, you know, wild salmon. Issues around, there's something called a sea louse, which is an external parasite that lives on both farmed and wild salmon. But since, you know, it's like anyone in Wisconsin knows what a confined animal feeding operation is.
Yes.
You know, all these animals packed into one place. And, of course, they're breeding grounds for all kinds of diseases. And the environmentalists are arguing, well, you're plopping down a CAFO right there in the middle of a wild salmon run, and of course you're going to have disease transfer. I mean, the one thing we don't have, like say, in Wisconsin, you know, you might have, you know, thousands of dairy cattle confined to a space, but you don't have wild cattle roaming around that could potentially get the diseases
mm-hmm.
that the wild cattle that the farm cattle are having. So, you know, it's both similar to the land food and also different, because we still do have viable seafood, wild seafood systems out there.
Mm-hmm. And it's a very lucrative business. I had no idea how much money was involved in this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we spent some time with a guy named Per Grieg, who's one of what, quote unquote, the five families of Norway that control most of the salmon farming. And he was telling us, I think his company's turnover was $400 or $500 million a year. So, and that's just because, I mean, salmon is hugely popular. It just recently became America's most popular fish, just past canned tuna, and it's only growing, and people do see or perceive it as a healthy food. They also like it. People just like salmon. It has, unlike, you know, your standard kind of fish fry fish, which is just white fish, salmon has taste. It has savoriness. You can do a lot of things with it in the kitchen, and so, of course, it's taking off.
Well, those people who are doing this for business must also be concerned about the sea louse, aren't they?
Yeah, they're certainly concerned about it. I mean, even the Minister of Fisheries in Norway, when I asked her point blank if sea lice were a problem, she said it is a problem. You know, and yet the ministry is hoping to increase salmon farming by, you know, a lot. They really want to increase salmon farming. And they know that the sea lice are probably a limiting factor going forward. And, yeah, you can have an infestation that will ruin a farm and ruin your profits. So you have to figure out, I mean, it is good animal husbandry to keep your animals healthy.
Right.
But then the question becomes the bottom line. Are people just pushing the system too hard to make as much money as possible, or are they trying to produce a sound product that won't interfere with the wild and will be healthier for themselves as well in the long term?
So maybe they could learn from some of the other places that you went just south of the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, so that was also Norway, but we went further north to a place called Kvaroy, and it's a little tiny island. I don't know, a few dozen people live on it. And this very nice family has started a salmon farm there, where they're really trying to kind of do best practices that they could figure out. So they're doing things like in the industrial salmon world, the most common way of getting rid of sea lice is using a chemical called slice, which is it's actually a shell inhibitor. And so if it gets it basically, since a sea louse is kind of like a crustacean, if you inhibit its shell growth, it will die, and you won't have a sea louse problem. Problem is if you put all this slice in the water, it's going to affect wild crustaceans that you want. And I never knew this, but Norway apparently has a very active fjord shrimp fishery. And once salmon farms go in and a slice goes in the water, fishermen report markedly decreased catches of shrimp. So what they're doing at this nice place in Kvaerøy is that they're using an animal called a lump sucker, which is a fish that actually cleans the salmon off, kind of like, I don't know, like a car wash. You know, the salmon come into this sort of fake kelp field that they've created for the lump suckers. The lump suckers pick off the sea lice, and everybody's happy. So they're doing that. They're doing alternative feed where they're not using wild-caught fish or directly wild-caught fish to make their feed. They're not stocking as densely. They're still making plenty of money. They have a really nice life up there. It's kind of like a, I don't know, you know, I know a lot of people in Wisconsin have Norwegian roots, but if you, you know, probably if you're from a Norwegian heritage, I think you have this fantasy of like the perfect Norwegian life, you know, with the upright houses and the crisp, you know, the crisp red paint and the clear waters. Well, like Kvaerøy is like the ultimate Scandinavian fantasy, and they're really doing it right.
It looked beautiful. We're going to welcome phone calls for you and hear more about what's on the documentary and urge you to see it if you didn't have a chance last night. It is online, pbs.org/frontline. Paul Greenberg is our guest. He was featured in the documentary, and he spent a whole year. He ate seafood, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and he traveled all over the world looking at fish farms, looking at what's sustainable, what's not sustainable, and it's a fascinating trip around the world and a very important look at what's in the ocean, what we eat in the ocean, why we're eating more of it, where it comes from, why we send frozen salmon to China and then they cut it all up and they freeze it again and send it back to us. It's kind of strange that that's the process, right? What kind of fish we're eating? What are some of the sustainable methods? Are there any that make a whole lot more sense than what's being done now? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. Paul is a New York Times bestselling author. He's an essayist, and he's been fishing since he was a kid. He has written American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood, and he is working right now on an upcoming book. I think I heard him say during the last half hour, it's coming out next year, The Omega Principle. This is the Ideas Network. All right, tons of phone calls coming in. Let's start with Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Two questions. The first is, I saw on the PBS station a while back some fishing that was, there were salmon caught in this vast, really big kind of spherical netting, and it was in the ocean. And I was wondering if that was considered farm-raised. And the other question is supplements from Canada. I think they have more stringent regulations on supplements than we have here, that supplements actually have to contain what they say.
Okay, Paul?
Yeah, so the first question about the without physically seeing the salmon operation you're talking about, it does sound like an aquaculture operation because they have these big circular nets that they are hanging in the sea, and they put salmon in there, and they feed them, and they wait until they've grown out to marketable size, and then they harvest them. So that's not really fishing. It's actually fish farming. And that is really the most common way that salmon is getting to your plate at this point. Is it sustainable? The Frontline documentary that we're talking about goes into a pretty deep dive about what are the issues around farming salmon. There can be very sustainable farm salmon out there. There can be companies that, you know, pollute the marine environment, don't really take care of how they apply anti-lice medication and things like that. So it really does run the gamut. On your other question about supplements, so we in this country certainly have issues around supplements, and I'm actually in the middle of sort of revising a chapter about this, so I don't want to go into too much detail. But basically, in the early 90s, there was legislation put through that kind of created a third category for supplements, something that's neither food nor medicine. And it's this in-between category that gets very light regulation, doesn't have to go through the kind of trials that medication does, and doesn't need the kind of approval that food does. So because of that third category, I would say yes, that there are a lot of issues around the supplement industry right now. As far as Canada is concerned, I don't know Canadian law very well, and I don't know how things are going there. But generally speaking, I know the European Union is certainly more stringent about a lot of things around medications as well as food. And it wouldn't surprise me if Canada is similarly strict. But when you're talking about fish oil, the main issue around fish oil tends to be is the source that you're using, is it coming from a rancid, potentially rancid oil? Because if the oil goes bad, it can have some, and it's oxidized, it can, some people say that it can have an effect on whether or not it's providing the benefit it claims to do. I've looked at a few different companies. There are a couple of companies out there that seem to me to be doing things in a more sustainable way and possibly a better way from a human health point of view. But I'll hold off on kind of saying which companies are.
Oh,
are
no,
right now.
Paul. People have their pens and papers ready.
You'll have to have me back on the show in 2018 because I don't want to kind of, you know, whenever you're working on a book, you don't want to go too far in before you've gone through the fact check.
Right. And when you're talking about, we were talking about farms in Norway and some of the problems with what may be in the fish and the louse and all of that. You also looked at what possibly could be in fish that's coming from India or coming from the Mekong Delta, coming from China. There aren't many regulations in many parts of the world, are there?
Well, it's spotty. It goes from country to country. A lot of our seafood is coming to us from Southeast Asia, from Vietnam, from Thailand. I did a New York Times Magazine story about fish farming in Vietnam about 10 years ago. And it was really, the main problem is there are so many farms. There are mom-and-pop operations, there are more industrial operations, and the way that people manage their farms is really different from farm to farm. The issue on our end of it, though, is that the FDA only tests about between 2 and 4% of all the seafood coming into
the country. Oh, my goodness.
They claim, when I've spoken to FDA people in the past, they've claimed that, you know, they have algorithms to determine, you know, what is safe and what isn't, and they feel that they can safely extrapolate from that small percentage that they actually test. In Europe, they do test quite a few more samples. And then there are other issues around farming of seafood, and there's just issues that have come up recently, don't have to do with human health, but the AP did a Pulitzer Prize-winning story about slavery in the seafood trade, particularly in Thailand. They found that there's a whole industry to feed all the shrimp that they're growing, and they have boats where they have to net up a bunch of sort of what they call trash fish, but it's really they're fish that they then grind up and turn into meal.
Mm-hmm.
But they found many instances of slavery aboard the ships that were catching that that fish for fish meal. They also found instances of slavery at fish processing plants throughout Thailand and other countries. So you are going into muddy waters when you go into foreign seafood, and it's one of the reasons, I mean, I don't have a lot of hard, fixed rules about seafood, but I do tend to prefer to buy American if I can.
Mm-hmm. Chris asks on Facebook, does it matter if the fishing happens in cold or warm water? It would seem to me that tropical oceans are more fragile.
Well, from an environmental point of view, anything is fragile if you don't have a science-based management program in place. So, certainly, we're seeing more intense climate effects in the tropics. I mean, we're certainly seeing dias of coral reefs and things like that. But we're also seeing big temperature shifts in northern reaches. I think the Gulf of Maine is warming faster than almost any other body of water on the planet at this point. So those changes do make ecosystems more vulnerable. They also make them more complicated to manage because, like in the Gulf of Maine, for example, codfish, you know, that was the staple of New England, and that was the thing that people caught in the Gulf of Maine. Well, now, because cod have been overfished and also because of climate change, different fish are moving into the Gulf of Maine, and so now there's a fish called a black sea bass, which probably most people in Wisconsin don't know, but it's a nice white-fleshed fish. It's usually associated with the mid-Atlantic, not the North Atlantic, but it's moving in, and there aren't really good management regimes to figure out how many black sea bass you could catch because they don't have any, you know, usual quota in that area. So it's getting complicated for sure.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to William in West Dallas. Hi.
Hi, thank you for the program.
Sure.
I'm wondering about sardines and what information you can give me about them. Are they an offshore fish, or are they caught in the shallows? Given the pollution in the ocean from microplastics to farm runoff to Fukushima radiation and third world dumping of chemicals into the ocean, is there a hazard involved with some fish, and especially sardines? And is my one can of mustard sardines a day, my beloved one can, harming?
I think you're probably okay with your one can. And maybe, you know, heck, I'll say you could have two. Sardines are what are called clupeids. They're a very prolific, large schooling fish. They can be near shore. They can be offshore. It depends. There are many different species of them, actually. As far as from a pollution standpoint, scientists have looked at toxicology studies of different fish, and they found, generally speaking, that fish lower on the food chain tend to be lower in toxics like mercury, persistent organic pollutants, which include PCBs. Those tend to be lower in smaller fish. So sardines is probably not a bad choice. Now, the issues around microplastics, this is an emerging issue that we, frankly, just don't know what's going on. There have been studies out there that saying, you know, within 50, 60 years, we could see more plastic in the water than fish. I think that's might be on the level of hysteria, but there is certainly tons and tons of plastic going into the water. They do form pellets that can then be absorbed by fish, and those little oily pieces of plastic tend to accumulate pollutants themselves. So it could be that they are a vector for pollution going forward. And I actually think the ocean plastics problem is going to be one of the most pressing issues of ocean management in the years to come.
We have a lot of pressing management problems.
Yeah.
Let's talk about doing too much fishing. There's a part of the documentary where you're with a friend, you're fishing along the Atlantic, and you're talking about how that area was just about fished out, that boats from the USSR, Europeans fished out.
Yep.
what we didn't fish out. So we got this congressional bill, the Sustainable Fisheries Act. You couldn't fish 200 miles out. And your friend says to you, and I want you to talk about this for a little bit, if you leave the ocean alone, it can heal itself.
Yep.
What did he mean by that, and is that happening?
Yeah, well, so the gentleman you're speaking of is Carl Cicina, and he's a very famous marine conservationist. There have been several developments that have occurred in fisheries management in this country. In the early 70s, there was something called the Magnuson-Stevens Act passed, which forbade foreign vessels from going into U.S. waters and fishing closer than 200 nautical miles. Prior to that, you had big, giant Soviet factory trawlers trawling off our waters, you know, within plain sight. Once that law went into effect, all those foreign trawlers got pushed offshore, but it didn't stop the overfishing issue. What then happened is that because suddenly there were no large vessels in those waters, the U.S. government actually subsidized the building of large American trawlers, and that in turn caused another overfishing event that really, really hit things hard. The thing that really turned things around was, as you mentioned, the 1996 Sustainable Fisheries Amendment to the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and what that did is said that we have to define what overfishing is. We have to look at all major commercial species and determine if they are overfished, and if they are, we have to end overfishing and then create a rebuilding plan for that species over a very discrete, defined period of time. Because, you know, we all see this in Washington now. Everybody kicks the can down the road, and what the Sustainable Fisheries Act said, no more kicking the can down the road. You have to rebuild these fish by 2014, 2015. We're actually hitting the deadlines for rebuilding, and we're actually finding in reference to that, if you leave the ocean alone, can it fix itself? Well, it turns out yes, because the rebuilding plans for fish have been tremendously successful, and we've seen over 36 different populations of American fish hit their rebuilding targets because of these really good strictures that got put in place. Mm. So surprise, surprise, government regulation can work.
Mm-hmm. William, thanks for your call. Matt in Middleton, hi.
Hi. A couple of questions. One, when we're looking at farm-raised fish, whether it be a land-based panfish like catfish or walleye, versus, say, a farmed ocean fish, does what they're being fed, such as, you know, maybe they're feeding them corn or soy products instead of what they would naturally feed on, change the nutritional value of the fish, and also whether they're more nutritionally dense as, say, a wild salmon or, you know, a wild-caught freshwater fish would be?
Excellent question. So this is something I'm sort of knee-deep in right now on my omega-3 book. But what we've seen in the last 10 years is that the fish farming industry has switched away from feeding fish to fish, partly because environmental organizations really got down on the idea that it took more pounds of wild fish to make a pound of farmed fish. So a lot of companies started cutting back and, as you say, replacing that fish meal with corn and soy. And what, you know, it's actually pretty hard to find hard data on this, but what my impression is that you're seeing fish that are primarily an omega-3-oriented piece of meat going to becoming more and more of an omega-6 kind of meat. Now, this, I don't want to go too deep into the weeds on this, but omega-6 are another class of what are basically essential fatty acids necessary for the human body. But as we've become more and more corn and soy-based in our diets, the natural ratio that probably primordial humans had of 1-to-1 omega-3 to omega-6 has shifted, and now our blood oftentimes or our diets are more like 15-to-1 omega-6 to 1 omega-3. So I think that's probably happening in farmed fish. Is that a health risk? Well, again, we circle back to this whole question of omega-3. If omega-3s are essential and if being out of balance is a problem, then probably a farmed fish that does not have a lot of fish in its diet is going to have the health properties more akin to a pig or a chicken or beef cattle. So that's an emerging thing, though, and I think we'll hear more about it as the years progress.
Paul Greenberg is our guest, and here's our phone number. He is featured in the documentary, the Frontline documentary, which aired last night, Fish on My Plate. It can be seen at pbs.org/frontline in case you didn't have a chance to see it live last night. He's a New York Times bestselling author, essayist. He's fished for a good chunk of his life, and he writes about the ocean, about fish, the future of the ocean, and his latest book, he's working on one now on omega fatty acids, and he has already written other books, including American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood. He ate fish 3 times a day. He traveled all over the world and looked at how fish is being caught. He looked at fish farms. He looked at salmon, and he looked at anchovies and many other kinds of fish, and it took him to some really interesting places in the world. So we have yet to find out if he's healthier as a result of all of this fish. We'll ask him that as we continue, and we'll take more phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, where we are delighted to read your messages always, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network. All right, our number is 800-486-8655. You had this group of people who were scientists who were looking at the future of fishing over for a great fish fest at your place, and that's featured in the documentary. Somebody starts talking about genetically modified salmon. I'm wondering what you think of that and if there are other forms of fish that are being genetically modified.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's important for listeners to understand that there is currently no genetically modified fish on the market right now. That said, the Food and Drug Administration recently approved for human consumption a genetically modified salmon. And we could see that fish as soon as, I don't know, next year or the year after. That fish, it's an Atlantic salmon DNA structure which has been modified with a growth gene from a Pacific salmon. And that gene, in turn, has been modified by a promoter from a fish called an ocean pout. And if you believe what they're saying at the company Aqua Bounty that has created this fish, that this salmon would come to market in about half the time as a non-modified farmed salmon. What do I think of it? Well, I'm not sure entirely that it's necessary at this point. The United States actually exports something like 80% of the wild salmon that it catches. So we still do have viable amounts of wild salmon in this country. And I think we might think about better maximizing that available salmon before we turn to genetically modified organisms. On the other hand, there is the best argument for genetically modified salmon is that people have said that the best way to grow salmon without hurting the wild would be to grow them in tanks on land so that they're not interacting with wild populations. And Elliot Entis, who formerly of Aqua Bounty, one of the creators of the company, his argument is, well, if you could just keep that, if you can make the fish grow twice as fast, then you can afford to grow them on land where oftentimes the energy inputs are much more. So, you know, generally I've been against an idea of a genetically modified salmon. I do see some logic in it, but I haven't really seen proof of concept yet. Mm.
And I wanted to ask you if you came away from that trip where this very interesting guy has mussels, clams, oysters, cleaning up the ocean, and doing a very simple way of fishing to get kelp. Are you a kelp fan?
I have eaten kelp. This is a guy, Brent Smith. And so he's not really fishing kelp. He's growing kelp, and I actually helped. You'll see in the movie, I actually helped seed some kelp beds where you wrap a line of larval kelp around a larger line, and then it just grows in these long curtains, and you can harvest it later. I've had kelp. It's I've had some of the young kelp, which is almost like, kind of like a baby spinach.
Huh.
It has its own qualities. It's not a familiar taste or texture to the average American, but again, the biometrics really argue for it. It grows extremely quickly. You don't have to fertilize it. It creates habitat for other fish. So it's kind of a win-win-win situation. Also, the other thing that you can co-culture with kelp are mussels, which, again, super high in protein, high in omega-3 fatty acids, no inputs required. So if you're looking for what would be the food of the future, mussels and kelp certainly should be among those new foods. The question is, could we get Americans to make them a major part of their diet?
Right. That's a big question. Tony is next in Green Bay. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, Tony.
I've been part of the Vital study since it started.
Oh, how interesting.
And it's been interesting. They do seem interested in a variety of things. They send us a questionnaire twice a year, both to make sure we're taking our pills and to find out if we have any, you know, all kinds of other things, you know, including heart issues or cancers or, I don't know, there's just a ton of things that they ask. It's about a 4-page questionnaire, and
that's why
so
they
it's been interesting.
So
that's why what?
That's why these things are so expensive.
Yeah, and it, you know, it's a double blind, so, I mean, not only don't we know, they don't know, but we're given two pills, and one or both of them might be real or not.
Hmm.
And we're supposed to find that out at the end.
When's the end?
Coming up, right?
It ends the end of this year.
Oh.
Yep.
So I'm looking forward to it because it'll been 5 years. And
oh, my gosh, Tony. How did you get involved in this?
They just sent something through the mail one day, and so I replied and said, yeah, I'd be interested in helping, and so I've been involved ever since.
Yeah,
I've been pretty good about taking my pills.
Well, that's good. I mean, that's one of the problems with the with randomized control trials is that people don't always stick to the regime that they're supposed to do. You know, I think you're one of, if I recall, something like 27,000 people that are on this. I can't remember, 17,000 or 27,000. It's in my notes, but I know it's a lot of people. And yeah, I mean, and the other issue that comes up sometimes when with randomized control trials on fish oil is that there's been reports that even if people are given the placebo, they can sense if it's fish oil or not because it might have, you know, a burp, kind of
right.
Fishy burp kind of thing. So that's something that can influence, you know, potentially influence the study. Have you experienced anything? Do you have any suspicions of whether you're on the placebo or on the real thing?
You know, I guess you always hope you're on the real thing, but you always suspect you're on the placebo, or at least that's where I'm at.
Yep.
Now, they did say that they took extra efforts to make sure that there would be no aftertaste if you had the, yeah. the real thing or not. And one difference I noticed was starting this last year, the fish oil one was always that kind of brownish color.
Yeah.
And suddenly my fish oil turned clear, just like the vitamin D.
Mm.
So I don't know what the deal is with that. They didn't really offer an explanation, or if they did, I missed it.
Mm. And will you be told at the end of the study whether you're placebo or the actual deal?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. I look forward to hearing that.
Great. And you can be part of another study where maybe you'll know what you're getting, which would be nice. Thanks, Tony, very much for calling. Nice to hear from you. What about you, Paul? You talked about you borderline cholesterol, high cholesterol. You had borderline maybe high blood pressure, some problems with sleep, et cetera.
Yeah.
So you checked your health. How did it turn out after all this
fish? Yeah, well,
now
that the film's out, I can reveal
something. Right.
But, you know, my doctor, who's this very laconic, you know, classic Upper West Side Manhattan physician, he was like, no effect. We seem to have seen no effect on blood pressure, no effect on cholesterol, no effect on triglycerides. Did have increased mercury. You know, that's just the sort of biometrics that you get when you go to the doctor. From an anecdotal point of view, I did feel better. I did lose weight. There is a funny kind of confounding factor of doing a fish diet study on yourself, which is that if you go to a restaurant, if you find, you know, if you notice, if you order the fish always comes with the healthy stuff, right? You know, if you order a burger,
you're right,
you get a side of fries.
Yes.
But if you order the salmon, oh, you get some broccoli, maybe a salad.
Right, exactly.
So I think that one change, you know, meant that I wasn't eating as much junky food. And I think my health did improve, although it might not have been picked up in the blood work.
Mm-hmm. Are you sick of it? Are you off fish for a while now?
Well, I backed off a bit because of the high mercury stuff. And I'm actually in the middle of doing an article for Audubon Magazine about a mercury study that's been done on birds, actually, in the Chesapeake. So I'm kind of getting into the weeds on the mercury stuff. So I backed off. I'm not obviously eating it all the time. But I like fish. So we have it, you know, 2 to 4 times a week anyway, which is already, you know, I think the USDA says we should, or said the NHI says that we should be eating a couple of portions of fish a week, and I've never backed away from that, but I certainly backed away from 27 portions a week.
Yeah, exactly. Sharon in Minocqua, hi.
Hi, this is another great program. I'm calling because I didn't catch the whole thing, so I don't know if you've talked about some of this. I'm just wondering about international, partnerships, international regulations, if there are any prospects of that, because I know that there's certain species of fish, indicator species, the one that comes to mind are like the menhaden, that kind of drive fisheries in other places. The Gulf menhaden, it's been reported how important it is to fisheries in other places, Mid-Atlantic menhaden. So, it's our oceans are kind of shared resources, so I don't know if there's ways or if there's any prospects for international treaties on really kind of helping to restore these fisheries at the international scale.
So there's a good question. There are many international agreements around fisheries. There is a whole set of 27 different bodies called Regional Fisheries Management Organizations, or RFMOs, and they oversee highly migratory fish like tuna, swordfish, marlin, things like that. Those are very complex negotiating places, and unfortunately in the past, even though science really should be the determining factor in how quota is allocated, politics often barges in, and that's one of the reasons why we did have a serious overfishing issue with Atlantic bluefin tuna, you know, the mighty bluefin that is the prize sushi of the world. Those management systems seem to be getting better up until our present administration, but now that we seem to have an administration in place that is, you know, bashful about engaging in fair play with our other nations out there, I think we're going to see international treaties suffer, especially around anything that has to do with the environment.
Mm. Thank you, Sharon, for the call. Paul, thank you so much. It was just a really wonderful documentary, and thank you for all of your conversation this hour.
My great pleasure as well. And, you know, I hope you guys keep enjoying your fish fries out there.
Oh, yeah, we do. Paul Greenberg, our guest, and Paul is featured in the PBS Frontline documentary that aired just last night, The Fish on My Plate. It's fascinating, and you can go to pbs.org/frontline. If you didn't have a chance to see it last night, you can see it at your leisure by going to that particular site. Paul is working on another book right now, The Omega Principle, which should be out early next year. And he is also author of American Catch, The Fight for Our Local Seafood, released a couple years ago. Thanks to Gretchen Brown for producing this program. And thanks to Colleen Leahy for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Thanks to Chris Molina for his help this week as well. News is coming up.